And welcome back to Dad's on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on fatherhood, men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and with me in the studio today is Ken Thompson.
Hi, Bill. Hi, everyone.
And today we have a very serious topic. Our guest is Cheryl King. Cheryl King is the enduring power of attorney for Liam McGill. Now, some of you may remember the case of Liam McGill. It went to the High Court, and we're going to hear a lot more about it from Cheryl. Cheryl met Liam way back in about 1999, I think.
That's right.
And she has been an absolute rock in helping Liam in his battles over the years. So, Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
When you met Liam McGill in 1999, I guess he just seemed like a nice fellow, then his story began to come out.
He seemed like a terribly nice man, and what I couldn't understand was what such a lovely man, he's good-looking, polite, all the things that women look for. He'd been single for so many years, and just a few months into our friendship, I realised that he had so much baggage, and I was actually just going to say, look, I'm not going to deal with this. I have to turn around and run away. Mm. But I felt so bad for him that I decided to stay and help. And I never realized that that journey would take me, you know, 16 years. And as we speak today, you know, I'm still fighting for him and I'm still banging his drum, so to speak, yeah.
So what did you find out?
First thing that we found out was this crippling child support payments that he was making, and he was the working poor. I mean, we've probably heard this story before. He had half of his salary taken out in child support to start with, you know, having to pay child support for three children. And then in June of 99, inadvertently, the child support agency decided that they were going to extract enough money from his pay that would leave him $132 a week on which to live. But then they actually adjusted it up to protected earnings amount to $200 a week. Now, you try living on $200 a week, go to work, pay your train fare, and have three children every second weekend. And it took them 3 months to correct that $200 a week inaccuracy. And it was a nightmare, and he was so down in the dumps, this poor man. So that's when I decided, look, we have to try and fix this. And at that point in time, there was some rumor about one of the children not being his children, not being his offspring. So we decided to, you know, start the process of trying to have all the three children DNA tested.
Okay, just before we go on to that, I understand he had debts mounting up of some $40,000, so he took money out of his superannuation.
What happened was he paid her a settlement divorce back in 1996, and he had to withdraw $40,000 from his superannuation fund in which to, you know, comply with the order of $40,000. Now, when he withdrew that money from his superannuation fund, it was deemed as income from the child support agency's point of view. So that totally inflated his income for that period, you know, that financial year. And, of course, the arrears started to mount, and they mounted and mounted to the point where at one point I was looking at his assessment papers the other day. His debt was up to $41,000 in arrears. Mm. Well, the child support agency had full control of what they deducted from his bank account, from his paycheck every fortnight. So if there was any arrears, it wasn't because he was responsible for them. It was due to the drawdowns and also the child support agency not contacting him saying, look, you've earned all this money, why don't you, you know... They wouldn't actually even allow any of the payments that he tried to make as non-agency payments.
Yes.
And a lot of people, I mean, the complicated hated events surrounding his child support account was horrendous. It took me a long time to try and understand how they calculate the payments. But in the end, it was because of the drawdowns that he ended up with this, with these arrears. And then, of course, when they tried to, when they did a change of assessment later to try and reduce that, after they found out that only one of those children was his, I mean, he should have been in a massive credit. But they wouldn't do that. They didn't want to disadvantage the mother. So they actually just gave him this zero balance and then continued to take child support out of his sickness benefit until about the middle of 2007, until the oldest child turned 18. So it was such a bad administration of his account, and it was negligent. I could go on about it for hours. Yes. That's how he ended up with this, with these arrears.
That was one of the major problems. So was there any particular reason why he suspected that one at least of his children was not in fact his biological child?
Well, what happened was the McGills were separated. She left him in 1992. So this idea of preserving marriage at the High Court was just rubbish. She left him in 1992, and she was a substance abuser. And in 1995, she was taken to a psychiatric facility because she had been, you know, and taking amphetamines and marijuana. And so she ended up in a psychiatric facility. Now, in that time, in 1995, Liam was, of course, still the father of all these three children. So he took time off work to look after these children for a couple of months while she was actually, you know, being treated. And at the time, he had access to her property. You know, her father, who had become guardian administrator of her affairs, gave Liam full access to her house so that he could facilitate looking after the children. And then, of course, you were tidying up and doing this, that, and the other. And then we found this wonderful, not we, was, I wasn't there at the time. He found this diary. And in the diary, she had actually been trying to get the biological father of the middle child to own up to being the child's father. And, of course, he wasn't going to put his hand up. And when Liam read that, he actually thought, this is just the ravings of a woman who doesn't even know what she's on about. He refused to believe the fact that this child wasn't his, because everybody had actually said how much he looked like Liam, that he looked like Liam the most out of all the children. So he just refused to believe it. So that was the first rumour that surfaced in 1995. And then he did nothing about it until I met him in 99, yes.
And then he thought he'd get a DNA test to resolve the question. Is that what happened?
Yeah, what happened was he then started the process of having the DNA, and he'd wanted to do it through the proper channels, through the family court. Well, that took a year, didn't it? She just wouldn't comply with any of the court orders to take the children in. We had about two or three hearings at the family court to make her comply with, you know, having the children, you know, give their samples. And then, of course, when finally it all happened, we only really suspected that one child may not be his, but it turned out that the two youngest children were not his children. He was devastated. I mean, the main reason for getting the children DNA tested, and it sounds a bit mercenary when I say it, but he just couldn't live on the money that he was earning, because so much money was being taken out by the child support agency. Mm-hmm. So if we thought we'd get relief just for one child, and then of course when he found out that the two children were not his, and by that time he was a mess, and he ended up just, you know, going off on sick leave and took up all his sick leave from his work, and then he ended up on a sickness benefit. It was a terrible, terrible time. I just felt so sorry for this guy.
We'll come back in a moment to talk about the effect on everyone else, but we're just going to have a short break now, and this is a song by Peter Gabriel called Don't Give Up.
Thank you. strong. We were wanted all along. I was taught to fight, taught to win. I never thought I could fail. No fight left, or so it seems. I am a man whose dreams have all deserted. I've changed my face, I've changed my name.
Don't Give Up by Peter Gabriel with a bit of help from Kate Bush. We're speaking with Cheryl King, who is the enduring power of attorney and an advocate for paternity fraud after her experience with Liam McGill in the famous case. Cheryl, oftentimes people say, well, maybe we shouldn't rock the boat because of the effect on the children of this all coming out. Was that a big consideration for you and Liam?
Big consideration for anybody that takes on this type of action. But the thing is, in one instance, you can't live. You're working, you can't live. And secondly, it's every man's right to know who he's fathered. I mean, and it's every child's right to know who their father is. I just think it's just a basic human right. Why would anybody object to that? And I think we're now in the 21st century, in the age of DNA, and anybody that thought that they had the right not to have the children DNA tested, well, I'm sorry, those rights are well and truly, you know, been outdated now. You really have to consider the fact that children need to know who their parents are, they need to know their medical history, you know, their bloodline. There's so many things involved here. What about, you know, children accidentally meeting each other who are siblings and they end up marrying? You know, it has actually happened where people have been fathered by the same man, a man and a woman, and they've been adopted or they've been, you know, for whatever reason, they haven't grown up together, and then they've ended up being in a relationship. And I've even heard of one couple who have actually had a child. And there's all sorts of medical disasters that can take place from children, well, people who have actually married, who are too closely related. We all know those pitfalls, yeah.
So how common is this, where the husband is not the father? I mean, I've heard some figures quoted, but what do you think the real figure is?
The stats that I received from Genetic Technology, they actually did the DNA testing for Liam's three children, And Ian Smith, who used to manage Genetic Technologies, I don't think he's working with them. I think he's actually resigned. But he said to me that the stats back in 2000 was that one in every five men who questioned paternity would have their suspicions validated. Now, of course, you know, there's four of them that will find out that they are the father. But one in five will discover that they're not the biological father. To me, that's just still a very high percentage.
Mm. It's extraordinarily high, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a high percentage. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I would. It just makes this a big issue. And perhaps that was a reason why the case wasn't well received in the courts, was because they were afraid of the social disruption if one in five of these dads found out they weren't actually the father.
Well, look at the social disruption when you find out that you're not the father and you try to get some sort of recourse. I mean, people have to survive. They have to live. I mean, you have to encourage honesty between couples, between married couples, de facto couples, whatever sort of relationship you're in. You know, the courts must encourage honesty, because there are so many things that can go wrong, and it's just, you know, the High Court allowed itself to malfunction in 2006. They did not deliver justice to Liam McGill. And you probably will remember, you know, that the public were outraged by that decision. It was an outrage. And I was actually reading some newspaper articles just a couple of days ago.
Cheryl, the decision was that it wasn't a responsibility for one partner to disclose their background to the other. Is that right?
Well, that's pretty much what they said, but in a very long-winded way. And now, of course, there's really good British case law now that's been handed down since the McGill judgment that completely refutes what the High Court of Australia handed down. You know, they've actually moved in leaps and bounds way ahead of us in the UK, and recent case law has really been, you know, I'm looking at it and I'm very heartened by it.
That gives us some hope for the future, because paternity fraud can only be committed by a woman, obviously, but it does affect others, doesn't it? It affects grandparents, aunts.
It affects children. It affects children. It affects fathers. It affects siblings. It affects aunties, uncles. Whole extended families are affected by paternity fraud. You know, some people I think it's actually referred to as paternal fraud in the most recent case in the UK, X versus Y. Again, they've suppressed the identities of the parents and the child because the child is under 18. But, you know, they are saying, and there's quite a few judgments, which I have in my little hot hand here. Some of them have been as far back as 2001, but most recently 2007, 2011, and there's other cases too, you know, in other parts of the world. But the ones that I'm most interested in are the ones that have been handed out in the Commonwealth, in our Westminster system. They're the sort of cases that we should be looking at to try and find a remedy for Liam McGill. I think it's quite relevant.
Well, the legal history here, and we haven't really said what actually happened, but it went to a local court. Liam was awarded $70,000.
That's right.
Then it went on appeal and it finished up in the High Court where there was a decision, but it was a split decision. There were three judges on one side, three on another side, but no one thought that Liam was entitled to compensation at the end of the day. And then, of course, there's a big question mark over one of the judges who, strangely enough, was in an identical situation to the mother in this case.
Apparently so, yes. And, of course, we probably can't go into great detail about that on this particular radio interview, but that's a very contentious issue and something that I'd like to talk about separately, if that's okay. The thing that I want to talk about today is the fact that we would like to attempt to reopen the McGill case based on this very good English case law. And, of course, we've got no money, but that probably hasn't stopped me from helping Liam fight this case. But we've actually set up a fighting fund, and we would so urge people, if anybody can just give even $20, that would make a huge difference. There's a lot of pro bono work, you know, going on behind the scenes here, but there are basic costs that you have to cover, you know, when you're trying to run it. Trying to get a case like this reopened. It's not easy. You know, we approached a great number of lawyers to see if they would take it on, and most people won't touch it with a barge pole. But we do have somebody who's interested in helping us, and we've got some fantastic support from Ellen Windsor in the UK, who was actually the instructing solicitor for quite a few of these cases in the UK. Again, they're all abbreviated X versus Y, A versus B. And
yes. So do you have a website, or if someone wants to contribute, what should they do?
It's actually a fairly new website. It's called Justice for Liam, and the justice is followed by the number 4 and Liam, all one word, .com.au. And all the details of these very, very good, successful UK cases are actually on that website if people want to go and have a look for it. Mm-hmm. And if they want to donate to assist us, it would be so appreciated. People, please don't think that just giving $20 is going to make you look like you're just giving a paltry amount of money. You're not. $20 will go a very long way if lots of people help us, because there is cost involved in taking this matter further.
We'll put that site on our website. And there's also a book, Leanna Cooper's book, Days of Tempest,
yes.
The Liam McGill story, and that's another reference point for people.
Yeah, a good book. It's got the initial trial in the book, and it's a good read. And Leanna Cooper was the only author that would actually write the book. We went to every publishing firm in Australia, and they wouldn't touch the book.
That's extraordinary.
Leanna Cooper wrote the book.
I was contacted yesterday by a man with a 43-year-old child who's in this situation, and he wants to change the law. Mm. Do you think we need to change the law, or is it just the court needs to make a decision?
Well, he's trying to introduce a bill into Parliament where they can actually make people over the age of 18 undergo a DNA testing. And, of course, that's a whole new area of law, which I myself personally don't know a lot about. He's actually, I think he's had it mentioned in Parliament, but, I mean, these things move very slowly, and I do hope it does get up for him, because his son is now in his 40s, lives in America, and he has a very good idea of who his biological father is.
Yes.
And he's trying to make, you know, his son undertake a DNA testing with the biological father to compare to see if it's what he suspects. So.
Look, we've come to the end of the show, Cheryl, unfortunately, but Cheryl King, we always ask our guests to pick a song. Could you tell us which song you've picked and why you picked it?
Oh, look, I just can't go past Mariah Carey's You're My Hero, because Liam's my hero. I mean, he's just been there. He actually created, you know, legal history when he won his case in 2002. He should never be forgotten for that. So it's actually just called Hero, I think the song's called. It's a beautiful song.
Hero by Mariah Carey.
Find love.
Now, that was Hero by Mariah Carey, and it just remains for me now to thank our special guest today, Cheryl King, for being on the program. Thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and thanks for asking me to talk today.
And we'd love to hear from any of our listeners, so go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email and we'll be in touch. And if you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au. And so until next week, it's goodbye from Dads on the Air.